Tom Rinaldi of ESPN, our guest. Paul, we've been looking forward to this.
He was a journalism school classmate of mine, and he's told the story here before, but I'm going to have to go back to the well because it's so good. He worked for a couple years on Notre Dame and in Indiana, if I'm not mistaken, partly because when he went to ESPN during graduate school and took their very difficult test, he did not know the backup first baseman of the Milwaukee Brewers.
John Jaha.
Who is currently the backup first baseman of the Milwaukee Brewers?
I still would fail, Mr. Kucharski. Yeah. Sure enough, I love being with you because I know if I'm ever feeling too good or high about
myself, same here, Tom.
That'll be corrected very quickly.
Well, it's a way of illustrating how stupid that question is, because nobody should know the backup. Brewers fans shouldn't know that Eric Thames, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing, is the backup first baseman there.
Oh, for the record, John Jaha was the starting first baseman, not the backup. And with my hand on a Bible, if you were in my home and went downstairs into my basement right now, because a good friend of mine shared that story with Jaha, the night before my wedding, he sent me a letter, Jaha did, that wanted to inform he wanted to wish me well, wish my future wife well, but also to let her know that she's marrying someone who perhaps doesn't know his business as well as he should.
That's pretty good.
That letter hangs up in my house with a signed picture from Jaha.
Did that quiz cost you an initial chance at ESPN, as far as you're concerned?
It very well may have. There could have been many other reasons not to put me in their employ then, too. But that certainly didn't help.
Well, we'll downshift into the somber occasion, anniversary of 9/11. And I've been waiting to talk to you about this really for a year because I messed it up last year. You wrote a book that tells just a heartwarming but gut-wrenching story of somebody who was in the towers, who was planning on maybe a career change from finance to firefighting, and who acted like a firefighter and a first responder that day, saved a lot of people, and ended up giving his life. Kind of tell us how you came on to Wells Crowther's story and how you managed to tell it.
So we told the story on television, Paul, for the 10th anniversary, and it was produced by Drew Gallagher, who now oversees College Game Day and does some other things with ESPN because he was a classmate of Wells at Boston College. Wells Crowther was a volunteer firefighter in high school as well as a standout lacrosse player. He played lacrosse at BC, graduated, took a job on the 104th floor of the South Tower, and worked for an investment banking firm called Sandler O'Neill. When the second plane struck, he began to make his way down the only functional stairwell left from the highest reaches of the tower. He got to the 78th floor, which was the Sky Lobby, a place where people took express elevators to then locals to the highest floors. He could have continued down and made his way out. He didn't. He stopped. He led a first group to safety, including a woman he carried across his back, firefighter style, down to the 61st, made sure the air was clear there, and then he went back up again, led a second group down. He eventually made his way all the way down to the lobby and still did not leave. He went instead to the FDNY command post to try to share, presumably, what he knew from the perspective of a firefighter. And ultimately, when his remains were recovered 6 months after this tragic day 17 years ago, he was the only civilian surrounded by a dozen FDNY members. And the book, The Red Bandana, that is the middle of the book. But we also talk about his life leading up to that day, as well as so many parts of the legacy, the discovery of what he had done, and the legacy that's come out of it since.
That, his father gave him that red bandana as a relative youngster. I'm sure you thought of this while you were reporting this out, and that his family did. But for that red bandana, he wouldn't have been so identifiable to these people who he saved, who later were able to tell his parents the story.
Exactly right. And that's the third part of the book, the third part of the story, which is in a way a detective story, because the survivors never knew his name. They didn't know what to help them. They only identified him through one thing, the fact that he was wearing a red bandana to cover the intense smoke that had filled the area on the 78th floor. His dad had given him that a red bandana when he was just a child on the way to church one day to blow his nose. For whatever reason, you know, Paul, how children, whatever becomes a talisman, whatever becomes important to them, he kept the red bandana with him throughout his whole life, wore it over his head when he played lacrosse, wrapped it around his backpack on the way to school, had it in his back pocket, even as he wore a suit and worked in finance. He always had one with him, and that ultimately was the clue that his mother read in a New York Times account, where she said, "Wait a second, I think that may have been my son." She then sent a photo of her son to one of the survivors identified, and that begins part of what the book chronicles in the incredible discovery of what their son had done.
ESPN's Tom Rinaldi with us on the Midday 180. Tom, in your research for this book, I wonder how many people that he came across that day wonder if they should have done what he did.
I think even more fundamentally, I wonder if I would have been able to do what he did. And I think, to be candid, I think the answer is no. I don't know that I would have had the courage and the character and the selflessness. Certainly now in my life, Wells at that time was a single man. He was only 24 years old. And now, as a dad with two children, married, all the other parts of my life, I just don't know that I could have gotten past that, in, let alone to just have the raw courage beyond the selflessness. That's one of the things I think that the book, in its own way, really asks people. Where does this kind of selflessness and reaction come from? How is it instilled in a young man? What are the institutions and the experiences that shape that? The parents, teachers, coaches, siblings, friends that all mold the clay so that in that one moment, in the ultimate fire, he responds the way that he did. It's a fascinating question.
Tom Rinaldi revisiting his book, The Red Bandana, A Life, A Choice, A Legacy, a harrowing tale of a 9/11 hero. Tom, I want to kind of transition from a piece of this book into your work. Your voice has become one of the most distinctive on television. I'm just going to read two paragraphs here and ask you a question. And I can't imitate you. I wish I could. I only do a bad Steve Spurrier. Fear and strength, smoke and blood, doubt and faith, terror and valor, the dead and the maimed, the way out and the walk down, the sacrifice given and the salvation granted, living, dying. It's all in there, the father says. It's all in that bandana. This style is very Tom Rinaldi. I think if I read that paragraph to a good share of sports fans in America, they would say it sounds like Tom Rinaldi. Where did you develop that voice? I don't think you're writing like that at Columbia because you weren't a full-fledged TV guy yet, and part of it is a TV script style, but where'd it come from?
You're very, very kind in saying that it's recognizable. I don't know that it, you know, I know part of the danger of that, Paul, just again, to be candid with you guys, is that you're typecast or people feel as though they've heard the same treatment of the same story, even if the story is different in its dynamics. And obviously each story deserves its own treatment. You know that as well as anybody. But in writing the book was a great challenge, a great experience for me, in that it both challenged and allowed me to write at much greater length. The original manuscript of the book was about 80,000 words. The book is 60,000. TV demands such ferocious economy that there's a lot of times when anything adjectival, anything descriptive is stripped away, and by choice, because you're wanting to frame the picture and sound. The page does not have the picture and sound. You must author that. paint that, shape that. And that was one of the, I think, the great challenges. I mean, we've been fortunate that, you know, the book was a bestseller on for the New York Times, and we've been really, it's been adopted by schools now, and we've been very honored by the fact that people have attached to the story. But ultimately, Paul, the last point here is what you want to do is honor the trust that people place in you. And especially in stories of this nature, this is the most precious territory in their lives. They are placing it in your hands, and they're saying, please honor this trust. Please do it in a way that makes us feel like this was the right choice. And there have been stories we've done where people have felt it wasn't the right choice, and we wear that weight, you know, with a great, great burden when that happens. But it's always the goal, always.
Tom, one more question for you. And anyone who's heard your essays on College Game Day or on ESPN knows what I'm talking about here. Have you always had this ability with your voice and your writing style to strike an emotional tone with people? Or is this something that you developed over the years and just realized you had when you started doing some of these essays on ESPN?
You know what's funny, and I don't know if Paul could speak to this because he knew me to 25 years ago. I still don't see myself that way. I'm fighting and clawing to get the salt passed at home at the dinner table. I'm just trying to get recognized in my own house. It's not like I talk and people start breaking down. And I also have to tell you that I actually think I don't narrate or track in our parlance particularly well, and I work hard to speed up, because the worst thing you can do is take a moment which already has power and then turn that into an overwrought diminishment of what it is on its own terms. Just frame it, say it, speak it. Hopefully, I'm still trying to do that better and better. And I still have a long way to go. But believe me, in terms of this power, you'd be laughed out of this house right now if any family member heard that. And I'm sure Garski threw up in his mouth when he said that.
Hey, you've done as well as anybody from that class or from that school. We appreciate you taking the time to visit with us. We hope the book has another flurry of sales here and that we can contribute to that. And we still appreciate you're giving us the overview of the Masters when we were at Augusta, and hopefully we'll see you again there somewhere soon.
Absolutely. And listen, I just before you go, I know you're probably up against it, I just got to get from each of you one sentence. What on earth did you make of the U.S. Women's Open final?
I thought it was pure insanity, but I couldn't turn away from it.
That is a very good description, Paul.
I was sad to miss it while I was getting ready to cover a 7-hour, 8-minute football game. So I only had to read it.
Okay.
And Tom, I missed it live. I had to go back and watch it because we were on the road for week one in the NFL. And watching it back, even though I knew what happened, it was just as dramatic.
It was absolutely riveting. I mean, it was it is a reminder, guys. Sport is so riveting because it's unscripted. There's no way anybody foresaw that happening, and no one could look away.
Well, and great job by you in the post-match interviews, too. I thought you handled it very well.
That was just trying to get out of the way there, get out on skate.
That's his MO. That's everything I taught him at Columbia.
There we go.
Tom Rinaldi, we appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Thanks so much, guys.
Tom Rinaldi has been our guest, and the book, The Red Bandana, worth the read.
It's on my stack. I need to get to
it. On a day like today. Wow. 17 years ago.